So far the models we've been studying have all been of this form. So took a bunch of fermions and we added on a quartic interaction. And there was a kind of, didn't use this before, but here's a kind of slick way to write the quartic interaction. So these are the currents. Well, it turns out that at basically any model of this form, where I take chiral times antichiral times J plus a JJ bar interaction, will always be integrable. So this is always going to be integrable. Now, you might worry that it's going to be, there aren't very many models of this form. What I want to explain today is that there are some of the most famous two-dimensional field theories, like the sigma models, are in special cases of this form. And therefore, everything we've done so far can be translated very easily to the case of sigma models. It doesn't work for every sigma model. But it works for enough of them. So let me remind you what the sigma model is. Suppose I have some Riemannian manifold. With the local coordinates, xi local coordinates, and metric gij dxi dxj metric. From this data, we can produce a two-dimensional field theory. So where the fundamental field is a map, say phi, from the two-dimensional space-time to this Riemannian manifold. So in coordinates, it's specified by n functions if n is the dimension of x, and the Lagrangian So it's the or 2, and I take the metric gij, and I view the metric as a function of phi. And then so this guy is going to be some complicated function of phi, and I have these terms with two derivatives. Okay, so I'm sure you guys have seen this before in like string theory. Yeah.
I guess with a special case of Minkowski space as being the manifold.
As being the tar this x is, so then the gij was just delta ij.
So yeah, the space time.
Okay.
For the beta function or something.
Right. So I think we will if we have time we'll do
that
the
assumption.
Okay. Isn't it surprising this is such a fundamental part of string theory? I guess the explanation for why string theory knows about the Einstein equations. I suppose, yeah, there's so much to be covered in these courses, it's very difficult. So, you know, these expressions might be a little bit confusing as to how to interpret these expressions. So let me just write down some metric and we'll see what it looks like. So for example, if g I j is delta ij plus something. I'm just going to kind of randomly write an expression. For example, so I want to write this just to explain how to interpret it. Then is integral delta ij plus phi I phi j del w phi I del w bar phi j. Right. So what happens is you take your metric, you take your gij, and you Taylor expand it. In the Taylor expansion, every time you see an xi, you replace that by a phi I. That will give you a big expression for this Lagrangian. So generally, if g I j is delta I j plus some kind of sum f I j j k1 kn xk1 xkn. So we just simply replace xki to phi ki in the Lagrangian. OK, they're reasonably clear. Right, so x's are coordinates on the space-time manifold, which is the target of the sigma manifold. The target of the sigma model. So x, like it should view x as a coordinate function. So phi I is I take my map phi I and I take my map phi and I evaluate the function on that map. So like phi I is the composition of my coordinate function composed with this map phi from and it's a function on space-time. Or like less mathematically, if we choose local coordinates on x, then a map from space-time to x is given by n functions. And x are the local coordinates. OK, so when we write something like this, it looks like it's going to be a little bit far from the form we wanted, chiral plus anti-chiral plus jj bar. However, for special x, it turns out we can write it in this form. The special properties we need for x is that we can choose coordinates on x which form a nice holomorphic coordinate system. Okay, so suppose we can choose local coordinates x I y I on x, and if we set u I is x I plus square root of minus 1 times yi, right, so we want to, these local coordinates say that there's n coordinates here, so x must be of dimension 2n, And these local coordinates are writing x as locally looking like the complex n-dimensional space instead of the real 2n-dimensional space. And the condition we want, the metric in these coordinates where the complex conjugate of this is GJI. So, you know, I take my expression for the metric in these, in the coordinates x and y. And then I can, of course, I, you know, this is just some change of coordinates. I can transform it into some expression for the metric in these coordinates. But a priori, you don't know, when you write it in these coordinates, it's not obvious that I wouldn't have a term du du or du bar du bar. I'm asking that I don't have any such terms. So there's one more kind of slightly technical condition you want. So this data means what's called is x is a complex manifold with the Hermitian metric. So if in addition, you can write this down for your kind of general knowledge, del u bar k g I j minus del u bar j g I k equals 0, then x is called Kähler. We're not really, this condition, we'll use it, but I think I'll kind of bury it under the rug a little bit. And I'm mainly writing this down just so, because you probably will see Kähler manifolds in other contexts. Yeah?
So, for this to be complex rather than almost complex, shouldn't there be a holomorphicity condition on the coordinate transformation?
Yes, but that's...
That's assumed in the Kähler condition.
Right, it's actually implied by this, right? Because if you can find local coordinates such that the metric is of this form, then the transition functions between them must be holomorphic. But you're right. It's that point should be emphasized. You want to know that you can do this not only locally in every patch, but then when you go between two different coordinate patches, the coordinate transformations are holomorphic functions of these variables. Okay, so let's take, here's one example. Suppose x is complex line, coordinate u, then I can take the metric g is du, du bar over 1 plus u squared squared. Let me just... Sorry, this is stupid, but I should always have to make sure I get these factors right. Yes. Well, in this metric, metric extends to u equals infinity and is the usual metric on the two-sphere. the usual Rand metric on the two-sphere. So this 90-fold is SU2 symmetry. So what's the SU2 symmetry? The SU2 is three generators given by the Pauli matrices. These are in the Lie algebra of SU2. And these act by sigma 1 is I times U del U plus complex conjugate. Sigma 2 is half of minus del U minus U squared del U. So if you're interested, you can check that these really do satisfy the commutation relations to define the action of the Lie algebra of SU2. And they also, these coordinate transformations preserve this metric. So they show that these are killing vector fields for this coordinate, for this metric. Okay. Okay, so once we have our manifold of this form, we can look at the Lagrangian for the sigma model. And we write it in a set of slightly different coordinates. So if x is scalar.
So given the top part of the board that you just raised is not really visible.
Oh, sorry.
Shadow.
We can use coordinates fields sigma I, sigma bar I, corresponding to the coordinates ui bar. Right, if we get some, you know, if ui was written in terms of x and y, then sigma I would be written in terms of corresponding fields. And then the Lagrangian takes the form integral of del w bar sigma I del w sigma j g I j sigma bar. So for the experts, there's also a topological term, which I am not going to be concerned with because it won't play any role in our perturbative analysis. Okay, so for example, so if x is as above. Sorry, this metric up here, I should have said, is called the Fubini study metric. There's a similar metric on every projective space. Then we have a single field. Well, sigma is complex conjugate. With Lagrangian. And you can see this is a quite a complicated expression, right? Because if we were to do perturbative analysis of this, we should expand this in powers of sigma. And each term will contribute a vertex in our Feynman diagrams. So there are vertices of arbitrary complexity. So what I want to show is that in this example, and in many others, this Lagrangian can be written as chiral plus anti-chiral plus JJ bar. So to understand that, we first have to understand how the general Lagrangian on a Kähler manifold can be written as a deformation, some deformation of chiral plus anti-chiral. Yeah.
Can you put the top order?
Sorry?
Can you put the top order on the middle?
Top order in the middle, okay.
Yeah, sorry, we can't really see it from here because of the lights.
Oh, yeah, the glare, I gotcha.
Sorry. It's either too dark or too light.
Can I ask a question?
Yeah, of course.
Sigma I is a like one-to-one correspondence to UI or one? Because we only have
yes.
one set of
U's. In like in the general Kähler manifold, if it's of dimension 2n, then there is n U's.
So in the case we had where it's just dimension 2, there would just be one set of sigmas.
Yes, exactly. So that's why I didn't put an index in that case. Okay, so the trick we're going to use to put this in a form more like the fermionic models we studied is to rewrite this Lagrangian in the first order formulation. So this is something, I think it's like standard in physics to study differential equations with two derivatives and correspondingly Lagrangians with two derivatives in them. But as you know, if you have a differential equation with two derivatives in it, you can rewrite it as a differential equation with the one derivative by introducing an auxiliary field, which plays the role of the first derivative. So similarly, we're going to introduce some set of auxiliary fields, which will be related, where the equations in motion will force them to be related to the derivatives of sigma. And then we'll get a first order Lagrangian once we have these auxiliary fields. So consider the Lagrangian that's written up there. Well, we're going to introduce auxiliary fields rho I bar. Which are of spin, these are both of dimension 1 and of spin 1 minus 1. These are the spins. So rho I looks like transforms as dw, rho I bar transforms as dw bar. Right, so the dimension 1, and then the spin under rotation is either 1 or minus. So the first thing we do is we just add on a kind of stupid term to the Lagrangian. First, we consider we take the same one we have. And then we just add on a quadratic term, or this is the inverse matrix. Sorry. That's the annoying terminology. All right, okay. Satisfies this equation. Now, once we do this, these fields here, they have no kinetic term. But because if we expand the metric, the leading term in the expansion of the metric will be delta ij. So they have a mass, but no kinetic term. So they don't do anything. They're effectively infinitely massive. So if you were classically, you would say that the equations of motion will set these guys to zero, and we're left with the Lagrangian we had before. At the quantum level, you would say that you integrate them out, and they don't introduce any new terms. So in either case, this is equivalent to the previous Lagrangian. And this trick is, so the trick we're using, add on some extra fields with a kind of stupid Lagrangian, which means you get rid of them and then do a change of coordinates, which we'll do now, is a very useful trick for putting basically any field theory in the first order formulation. You've probably seen this in relativity, or when people study gravity, that's what they do as well.
Argument of how this Lagrangian is equivalent to the previous one. Sorry, I didn't get
that. Okay, so at the classical level, you see the Lagrangian is equivalent to the previous one by solving the equations of motion and realizing that, say, varying rho I will tell you that rho bar j must be zero because this is a non-degenerate tensor, the leading term. Similar to the other guy, right? This guy, see, this guy must be zero. At the quantum level, you have to think a little bit more about it. It would be easy, suppose if we just had this, if this guy was just delta ij, it would be easy to understand at the quantum level, because then we would just say, well, they're not actually coupled to the field sigma at all. We just integrate them out, we get nothing. You have to think a little bit to see why when they're massive, you can integrate them out, why doesn't that introduce some deformation over here? But you can convince yourself that's not the case. Okay, so the next part of the trick for writing it in the first order formulation is we basically just complete the square. We do a change of coordinates where I add on to rho I some multiple of this guy, of the from the del w sigma bar. And similarly for rho bar, and I choose the terms I add on carefully. So that when I change coordinates, the terms involving two derivatives have been canceled. And I'm just left with terms involving one derivative. So here's how that works. We set beta I equals rho I minus g I j del w sigma bar j. Beta bar I, rho bar I minus g j I del w bar sigma j. And then, you know, to put it in. For some reason, I'm going to rename sigma as gamma, sigma bar as gamma bar, just because this is the traditional notation. This situation. And then the Lagrangian becomes Well, the first term is still there. It's actually on. Let me do this later. It's too confusing. Inserting the expression for rho I in here, I get something quadratic in the sigmas. So the thing I get is, it'll just cancel for a stupid reason. I think I have an index. And if we just contract these indices, these two terms just cancel. And by looking at this Lagrangian, we see there's going to be a couple of other terms. There's a term quadratic in beta. There's a term linear in beta and linear in sigma. Sigma bar, linear in beta, linear in sigma bar, linear in beta bar. So let's just write out those other terms. Minus integral. Beta j, g, I, j. Signs don't really matter. Okay. So these first two terms cancel, and we're left with these three terms. Maybe I'm missing a factor of two or something, but just some simple algebraic manipulations. And we notice some nice features of what we found. So this part here is chiral. This part here is anti-chiral. This part here is some deformation. So we're kind of getting closer to what we wanted. Chiral plus anti-chiral plus a deformation. These are chiral because it only involves derivatives in one direction. And you also notice that this term does not depend on the metric on x. So this only depends on x as a complex manifold. These two terms. That is, if we locally choose a coordinate on x, the metric just does not appear. X might as well have been flat space, as far as these two terms are concerned. The metric dependence is only appear in this here, this term here. And final thing to note is that the thing quantity appearing here is the inverse metric. Because we inverted the metric in order to perform this change of coordinates. Okay, any questions so far? How about this manipulation? Yes.
I guess the definition of chirality is in terms of fermionic things which are left-handed or right-handed. Here we're just extending that definition to bosonic fields.
Let's see. I would say chiral means, suppose we were in Lorentzian signature, then W and W bar would be coordinates, would be null coordinates, left and right moving. So in Lorentzian signature, this Lagrangian, well, things only propagate in one direction. So that's one way to think of what chiral means. But if you think a little more about it, you'll find that it looks like a TFT in the W-bar direction. So it's some independence of it only depends on the holomorphic structure. I don't know what to say. Okay. Let's look at this example and see what it looks like. Suppose x equals c, just erase this. The metric is du bar 1 plus q squared. The inverse metric. Is 1 plus u squared. So think of this as, you know, g1. So g lower 1. So our Lagrangian is I'm going to change the sign. Beta I, beta bar j, 1 plus sigma. There's no indices. 1 plus sigma bar squared plus integral beta del w bar sigma plus integral beta bar del w sigma. So this is I find this expression nicer because it's a finite Taylor series in the fields. So what I'd like to show is that, well, we see here the Lie algebra of SU2 acts on C by these vector fields. And what I want to show is that this term is JJ bar, where J are the currents for the action in terms of this free theory. So wear that out. So the claim is that SU2 acts on the free theory. And the interacting term is JJ bar. So why is that? Let's So to figure this out, we have to figure out, like, what are the currents for the actions of these vector fields on the target? Now, is there a question? I mean, as an aside, you notice, say, just focusing on the chiral part, we didn't use any properties of the complex line. We didn't use any metric. So all of the infradimensional symmetries of the complex line are symmetries of this theory. There'll be currents for all of them. But we're only interested in the currents for the first three of them. So what are the currents for del u, u del u, u squared del u in the chiral theory? So del u is an infinitesimal translation. So it translate this field sigma. Sigma goes to sigma plus epsilon. So del u, we translate sigma. So if you remember how do we figure out what a current is, we have this symmetry where sigma goes to sigma plus a constant. It's clearly a symmetry of the Lagrangian. Now, we must add on a background gauge field coupled to this symmetry. The coefficient of that background gauge field will be the current. So if A W bar is a gauge field which gauges the symmetry, then the Lagrangian looks like right. This is the important points. So I want to make sure you guys understand this. We take the usual thing. When we gauge the symmetry, we're translating sigma. I'm having difficulty finding the words to explain why this is obviously true. But is it clear to you guys that? If when we try to gauge the symmetry with the background gauge field, that the background gauge field is coupled by this expression. Okay, great. So therefore the current for J for del U is beta. Okay, similarly, the current for u del u, well, that's also a symmetry. Because it's linear in u, in sigma, this just scales sigma beta with opposite weight. So the current for j u del u is beta sigma. And the current for u squared del u, well, u squared del u sends sigma goes to sigma plus epsilon sigma squared. So the current is easily seen to be beta sigma squared. So similarly in the A similar thing happens in the anti-chiral theory. So for the three poly matrices, J sigma, get it backward. I realize, looking at my notes, I had a slightly quicker way of doing this. So we can calculate the sum J sigma I, J bar sigma I, by calculating the metric, the inverse metric.
And it probably should be pointed out that you're using sigma both for the fields and the generator.
Oh my god, yes, I totally am. That's terrible, yes.
And that's why you probably want to switch to gamma initially at some point.
But yes.
Anyway, just pointing that out.
Okay, good point. Is sigma is so overused, right?
Yeah, I guess one has an index, the other one doesn't, so it should be okay.
Yeah. Okay, I mean, that's it. I think you guys can see how the rest of this calculation will go. We have J bar, we figure out what J is for each polymatrix. We multiply it by J bar for the same polymatrix. We find the term of the Lagrangian. This claim will be exactly this term up to some coordinate transformation. So let me explain to this slightly quicker. We look at what sigma is. So the inverse metric is, I take sigma one u bar, like the holomorphic and anti-holomorphic piece, plus sigma two u bar, sigma three u bar. So what's this? I multiply all these coefficients together. So the del u will just kind of come along for the ride. Each has just a function of u, and I multiply those coefficients together. So I find and then after the coordinate change, then u bar to 1 over u bar inverse, this becomes just what we wanted. Okay. Man, every lecture I feel there's one point where things go quick and nobody follows. So I've forgotten that we have to do this coordinate change. An alternative way to make this derivation, which is probably would make more sense, is that I use the sigma one, sigma two, sigma three for u, the chiral currents. And then I have this coordinate change in the anti-chiral piece, and I just put that directly into the currents or into these sigmas. Then I multiply it all out. Like I work out what the polymatrices look like in the coordinates, minus one over u bar. Then I plug those in, and I find this expression. Any questions?
The last part you just wrote up is finishing this thing or another way of getting it?
So it's a bit disorganized here at the end. So the last part was trying to finish the argument that the sum of these guys give you the metric we wrote down on CP1, the 1 over 1 plus normal u squared metric. Or that gives you the Lagrangian for the sigma model on CP1. But I was doing it a bit quick by saying, well, instead of writing out these formulas for the currents, let's write them out for the vector fields u w, u squared w, because they're basically the same thing. Right? How do I go between them? You know, del u becomes beta, u becomes sigma. So they're really the same thing. So I was just writing out this calculation, and then noting you can perform a coordinate change on the space on the target of the sigma model, which will put the metric in the form we wanted. So we've concluded that conclusion is that the sigma model on the two sphere is free chiral plus anti-chiral plus JJ bar, which should imply that it should be integrable. Maybe I should have started with an easier example, but okay. I can do another example next time. Are there any other questions? Yeah.
So, sorry. I can see the analogy with the fermionic models we looked at, and therefore we are claiming that it's integrable. Is that?
Yes. So. I mean, I didn't really justify the statement that chiral plus anti-chiral plus JJ bar should always be integrable. But I think we're going to look at that more later detail.
That is implied in the structure, right?
Yes. In fact, they'll have the same formulas for the lax pair. Like 1 over z times j plus 1 over 1 minus z times j bar. It will just be some formal properties of the equations always satisfied by currents that this will set, that the lax equation holds. In fact, I think one of the tutorials was about something similar.